Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. And now, here is Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome to the Walter Bingham File for December the 26th, 2017, which in the Hebrew calendar is the 8th of Tevet 5778. To help our friends in their efforts to counter the anti-Israel propaganda, I shall later in the program discuss with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach his latest book titled The Israel Warrior, which gives a clear and concise history of our claim to this land and helps to counter the fake history and arguments disseminated by our enemies. But first, this. You know, one of the recipes for success in life is to look forward and to plan. But sometimes it's interesting to look back because we can learn from our mistakes or from the results of our actions or in the world of politics to prove yet again the impossible. However, if it were left to the grassroots, coexistence could possibly be achieved, as we shall see in a moment. So in the first part of the program, I look back on what I saw and did some years ago, recorded in one of my shows on another station. So here is what I mentioned in August 2013. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has promised the final status agreement with the Palestinian Authority within 9 months. Well, he has been and gone a long time, and with it, that final status agreement. Israeli peace negotiators were on another free trip to Washington, trying to achieve the impossible and spending thousands of dollars in the process. And, against all previous experience, another 104 terrorist prisoners were to be released from Israeli jails. And the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, has said that in a future Palestinian state, there will not be a single Israeli. In fact, it will be Judenrein, free of Jews. So nothing at all has changed to this day, has it? The statement by Abbas is significant when you compare it with the equality that Palestinian Arabs enjoy in Israel.
And in light of all that, together with a number of foreign journalists, I was taken by the government press office to see the Barkan Industrial Park, situated in Samaria, in what is known as Administrative Area C of the West Bank, just outside the city of Ariel. Usually, when we hear or talk about the so-called West Bank, it is through the prism of politics. The purpose of this trip was to show a people's approach can make normal coexistence between Palestinian Arabs and Israelis possible.
Howdy, this is Rita from League City, Texas, now living in Israel. And though my heart may have belonged to Texas, it now belongs to Israel and all the fantastic show hosts at Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Michael Solomon from Kiryat Arba, Israel. And why do I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio? Because I love listening to the interesting interviews they do and their news reporting that most other media sources don't cover.
Hey, this is Nicole Eko from Malmo, Sweden. It gets pretty cold here in Sweden, so I love cuddling up with a warm cup of tea while I listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Frank Morris from Tennessee. Me and my dog Buster really love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
A people's approach can make normal coexistence between Palestinian Arabs and Israelis possible. The Barkan Industrial Park houses almost 200 factories, providing employment for more than 3,000 Jews and 4,000 Arabs, working peacefully side by side. The official Israeli estimate of Arabs working in Israeli industries in Judea and Samaria is 11,000. Palestinian Central Statistics put it as high as 20,000. One of the large Israeli factories for plastic plumbing and sanitary products in the Barkan Park is Lipsky Limited, and that is where we visited.
We were greeted by the CEO, Yehuda Cohen, and following a walk through the almost fully automated production area, he gave a comprehensive description of the harmonious atmosphere among the workforce and a sometimes emotional explanation of how the European boycott affects his company because of its geographical location. Here are edited extracts from his talk.
But it's important that you saw people, and I believe that nobody understand who was Israeli and who was Palestinian. And this is more important for the relationship that we're trying to do. The first target is to make money. And the second target for me is to build bridge for peace between the people. Rashid is assembly management in this company. I have few Palestinian management and few Israeli management. I'm under a boycott from the Palestinian Authority. In the same village at Salam Fayyad, burned my product in the village, Salfi. 25 people from this village working with me.
It's not a simple man. This is a prime minister. The prime minister burned my product.
Salam Fayyad was prime minister of the Palestinian Authority between 2007 to 13.
And for me to burn a flashing system, it's like what happened more than 70 years ago. They burned books, a lot of knowledge, a lot of work on this product. And to put the product in fire, it's like when we burn books. I believe that what you see here brings a hope for the people, builds a bridge for peace, and any kind of boycott, if it will success, destroyed my idea, destroyed the industrial area, bring suffer to the people. The law said that any people in the West Bank, in the Palestinian Authority, who hold my product or buy my product, he can go for 5 years jail and $14,000 damage. This is the law.
But if that is the case, how can they then allow the Palestinian workers to work here?
They try to boycott the Palestinian to coming work here 2 years ago, but they understood that it's too much for them and didn't enforce. I believe that this industrial area should not pay tax to Europe. The European, they don't labeling the product, but they're labeling the company. This product that coming from this industrial area should get a bonus, because I call them a peace product. They pay 7% duties and the Israeli government bring it back. This is the Israeli law here. The same salary for Israeli and Palestinian, including pension, including all the social conditions. It's the same.
Asked why he established a factory at this location, he said,
this company belonged to the Keter Group until 2 years ago. And I worked with Keter more than 15 years. After 8 years, they asked me to build a new company. And I did it in Lod city. And it was too small for me. And I looked for a new place. And I found this building 7 years ago. And I rent it. This was the first decision why I came here. I tell you the truth. I feel very happy to work with Palestinian and Israeli. The Palestinian, they look for work. They need work. They don't have any kind of help from the government. They don't have any kind of getting better salary like what we can give them. And all the people who are working with me, I feel wonderful with them. I know when I give them normal condition and respect, I get a wonderful partnership from their side. And it's easy for me to manage a company here.
One question asked if the government gives any subsidy for creating employment here.
I didn't get even one shekel from Israeli government because I'm here. Not in investment, not in help. When the Palestinian boycott started, I lost 17% of my business. It wasn't easy for me. And I didn't get any help from Israeli government. I'm here because I want to be here, because I believe that what I'm doing, it's the best bridge for peace between the two people. And it's good to be here because it's easy to manage a company here.
You told us before that you were being pressured to move the factory because of the boycott.
Remove this factory to Ashdod city, inside the Green Line. This is a public company. It's a guy from Herzliya who holds 64% of the shares.
And so far you've been able to resist that.
I didn't resist. I just said what I think. I told him he can do it by himself. I will not be part of that because I don't believe on that. And in my age, I can do what I want to do. And if somebody wants that I will be part of his business, he should decide. He can remove me. I can go work. I live in a kibbutz. I have 700 cows milking. I can go there.
I addressed the next question to Rashid Mraal, a Palestinian Arab who manages production at Lipski Limited. What happens to Palestinian workers in the villages? Is it accepted that you work here, or are you being shunned?
He says there's no pressure whatsoever. He doesn't feel that he has to keep it a secret. And when he reveals to everyone, it's not like he's under pressure to quit his job or why you cooperate with this factory or this owner or whatsoever.
Most of the workers are getting double or three times the salary here from what they can get in the Palestinian Authority. The question is, if the boycott will success, what will happen with the people? What will happen for the bridge for peace? Any kind of boycott destroys this hope. And I ask the European, don't fight against the industrial area. You can fight against the government, Israel and Palestinian. But this industrial area, we should increase, bring more war, bring more hope for people. And that's what we're doing. And if the European will success with the boycott, they destroy this hope.
Do you have a large turnover of Palestinian workers?
Look, it's a wonderful place. Maybe 1-2 persons, but most of the workers want to come to work every day. The Israelis, they don't want to leave me, and also the Palestinians don't want to leave me.
Rashid was asked how he feels about the boycott by the Palestinian Authority.
He doesn't agree with this boycott. This factory supports 50 Palestinian workers. All over Balkan, there's about 3,000 Palestinian workers who can get affected from this boycott. If sales go down, it affects the people's salaries that work here.
Is this fair to say that the Palestinian Authority, on one hand, boycotts the products and the industry, but on the other hand, turns a blind eye to the people that actually want to work in the industry?
I think that if the Palestinian Authority continue with the boycott people coming work with me, they open intifada against them, because people want to leave. We are not a settlement, we are industrial area, and we bring hope for the people. Let's think that industrial area is out of the conflict, and leave the conflict to the politician to solve. If it will be Israeli, we can continue. If it will be Palestinian, we can also continue. We should not destroy the industrial area. It was a Jordan land, not a Palestinian land. Don't forget it. And it's happened 47 years ago. We are looking for a solution for peace. Leave the industrial area by side. You want to pay tax to the Palestinian villages? Let's pay tax. We want other solution? Yes. Until they will find the right solution between the leaders.
I can understand that as a manager of this industrial concern, you are interested in nothing else but keep your factory going. But with great respect, I think it's a little bit naive, if I may say so, to expect your industrial area to be an island within the greater scheme of the politics.
It's not an island. Why we say this is a settlement? We are not a settlement. We are an industrial area, and we bring hope for the people. I born in a kibbutz. I live in a kibbutz. I know Palestinian from when I was a little child. Don't forget, the Jewish and the Muslim are cousins, and a lot of our culture are the same. It's not an island. Maybe in Europe thinks this is an island. This is not an island.
He totally misunderstood my question. I wanted to hear why he thinks that the industrial area should be kept completely out of any territorial negotiations. And if he accepts the option of becoming part of a Palestinian state, what makes him think that he can remain there when Abbas repeatedly stated that in Palestine there will be not a single Israeli? He means well for his business and his employees, but is unfortunately a little naive. From the Barkan Park, we continued to Ariel University. At the university, we had another opportunity to see life with Arabs in Samaria from a totally non-political perspective, hearing from several Arab students why they chose Ariel and about their life there. We were also addressed by the president, Yehuda Danon, whose CV reads like a book. Here are some of his significant achievements. He is a medical doctor who did postdoctoral work as a Fulbright scholar at UCLA, and from 1986 to 1991, he was the Surgeon General of the Israeli Defense Forces. As a pediatrician, he built the Schneider Children's Medical Center, the first children's hospital in Israel. His specialized field is immunology, particularly vaccines, and he developed the smallpox vaccine that was used by the U.S. Army in the first Gulf War. Professor Danon has been in his present position for the past 6 months. Here are some of his remarks.
We are the eighth Research University of Israel. The first universities of this country were built before the inauguration of the State of Israel, the Technion in 1919, Hebrew University in 1924, Bezalel, and the Weizmann Institute that started also 1935, so four before the inauguration of the state. And since 1982, no new university was added. The decision of the government of Israel, 2005, was to increase the possibility of underprivileged students to get academic studies and to build two new universities, one in the Upper Galilee and one in Ariel. The process of transformation to university lasted from 2005 to 2012, 7 years. We have five faculties and two schools: engineering, faculty of medical professions, humanities and social sciences, school of architecture and school of communication. We have no faculty of law. We have so far 16,000 graduates. Last year we added about 2,000 new graduates, so altogether 18,000 graduates. And this coming academic year that starts beginning of October 2013, we will have 15,000 students. Our staff is almost 300 professors. We are strong in technical sciences, in exact sciences, all fields of engineering. And the new coming, less developed professions of liberal studies and humanities.
Israel is located in one of the most volatile areas in the world. Israel is an island of stability in a sea of war and unrest. In the midst of this turmoil, Israel stands out as a beacon of order and human progress. Each week we update you on what's happening in this, the Jewish state, a true light unto the nations. This is Jay Shapiro. Join me every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Here is Walter Bingham.
Our budget is about 300 million shekels a year. We are a public university, not a private university. The annual tuition is 10,500 shekels, meaning about $3,000. So you can get your bachelor's degree with $9,000 for tuition. Most of our students, unlike United States or some European countries, are not taking loans. So they are working or they are getting allowances from the government or from their municipality or from their family. In addition to the tuition, the other sources are allocations by the Ministry of Education, the High Commission of Academic Studies, and research and development grants, and we are getting about 50 million shekels a year of research grants from different sources, most of them competitive sources. As you know, we cannot get European grants. That is true for the last 30 years. The college started in 1982, so 30 years we are not getting European grants. Just now it was on the media. It's not new for us. We know it for the last 30 years. We have the national resources of lasers and FEL, which is quite important part in a study of basic physics. We have the only linear accelerator for research purposes in the state of Israel, in addition to the one that is existent in the nuclear reactor in Nahal Shorek. But no other university has such a linear accelerator, and we are building a new one now. Our rector is also, we call it in this country, newcomer. He came on 1982, but, you know, everyone that is a newcomer for almost the rest of his life. We have a few projects that are for the benefit of all the citizens of Judea and Samaria, Jews and Arabs. It's one of the main advanced research projects is a project of recycling of sewage water. As you know, Israel is using about 95% of the sewage water for recycling and use it in agriculture. We have developed a small recycling plant for small towns and villages. It serves the town of Ariel that has about 20,000 inhabitants, and it serves the industrial zone of Ariel. lack. It's the quality of almost drinking water. Nobody drinks it, but it can be used for gardening, for agriculture, for vineyards, for almost for everything. We have a special program called Meteostat for detection of big fires. It uses satellites and a special reception system. And the big fire that we had in the Carmel Mountains was detected by satellite, as you have a fire of more than 500 square meters, half a dunam. In the summer, we have a special program of MBA for students coming from Russia. We have every year about 40 to 50 students, and they are studying in English and Russian.
Who were the main objectors to you being granted university status?
The main objectors were political bodies in Israel that were outruled by the Supreme Court, and five of the seven universities that appealed to the Supreme Court, asking that their budget will not be harmed by our position as a university. But speaking on history, the first university that was inaugurated in Israel was the Technion in 1919. And on that stage, in Palestine, there were 80,000 Jews. So 80,000 Jews formed two universities. And this was a real political act of the Zionist movement to start academic schools in the land of Israel. And the big quarrel was on the language of teaching, because nobody believed that engineering can be taught in Hebrew. And the people wanted to teach it not in English, in German. And that was the quarrel, to teach in German or to teach in Hebrew. When Hebrew University started and Lord Balfour came to lay the cornerstone for the Hebrew University, immediately Lord Samuel, that was the governor of Palestine, representing the crown of George VI, got a letter from the American University in Beirut objecting the inauguration of the Hebrew University, saying that we, the American University in Beirut, are serving all the academic needs of the Middle East, and we do not need an additional university in this area. When the School of Law and Economics on 1935 started in Tel Aviv, the University of Jerusalem objected the opening of the School of Law and Economics because they didn't want an additional university in Palestine. Later on, when Tel Aviv University started, all three universities objected Tel Aviv University. When Weizmann Institute wanted to start master's program, all four universities objected Weizmann Institute. So that's the story. That's the story of academic life in the Middle East.
Who were the political entities?
Shalom Achshav was objected. Disadvantages, you know, everybody living beyond the green line can see it in the regular life when you travel. Our main difficulty is that we are kind of a secret place. And for many of the people in Israel, they've never visited here. They've never seen the university. They only read about it in the newspapers, and they have no idea what's happening here. The people in neighboring countries, if you ask them about a Ariel University, they see no difference between a Ariel University and University of Tel Aviv that was built on the land of Sheikh Muniz, or the University of Jerusalem that was built in Mount Scopus on the land of Isavia, on Givat Ram of the Hebrew University where I studied, that was built on the land of Sheikh Bader. And I can go on and give you a name of different communities. For them, everything is an occupied area. Every grain of land from the north up to the south is an occupied area.
Here is what I asked the university president in a short interview. You said that for the next academic year, you have 15,000 students. Do you have more applicants than you have places?
Yes, absolutely. You cannot put it all in one basket. We have many of our departments and our faculties that have a very high number of applicants. I will say that civil engineering, electronic engineering, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, communication disorders, nutrition, they have the biggest number of applicants. And the competition there is about 3 to 4 to 1, meaning 3 to 4 applicants for every position. Then the School of Architecture has a very big number of applicants, social work and psychology. They have about 2 to 2.5 to 1 place in terms of applicants to positions.
Which is the faculty of which you are most proud here? Of course, you are a medical man, but which is the faculty?
I am a medical man, but I came to absolutely different life, academic life, and I am proud of all the faculties. I cannot do any discrimination, but my main task is to develop the field of Judaism and humanities, which is not existent at this point in this university. Hopefully, in addition to that, we will get the license to open pre-medical studies, meaning the first 3 years of medical school.
How about entry examinations? How strict are they and what do people have to do?
The entry examinations all over Israeli universities are what we call the national psychometric exam. There is a very big quarrel among academic people in the Ministry of Education. Do we need the psychometric exam, or it's enough to have the matriculation grades, or we need an interview? So in all those faculties that there is a very big number of applicants, the scoring is done by combination of all three, meaning matriculation, psychometric exam, and interview. And each one of them has the same level of significance, meaning one-third of the qualification.
Why should students choose Ariel over other universities?
It's a very good question. As a young university, we are very proud of the very good and open relations between the academic staff and the students. They all live in one community. It's all based on big friendship between the students and the academic staff. And I believe that big part of our appeal is the appeal of the special relations between the academic staff and the students.
Is it on a first name basis?
Yes, generally it's a first name. Even me as the president, everybody calls me Yuda, like my grandchildren. Nobody calls me the president.
Thank you. My conclusions of the day's experience, I wished it were all that simple. Unfortunately, what we experienced on this trip was not the norm of life with Palestinian Arabs, but exceptions.
And now to my conversation with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. Shmuel Boteach, or Shmuley as he is affectionately known, is an American Orthodox Jewish rabbi, author, TV host, and public speaker, and the author of 30 books, most of which have a religious theme and have received public acclaim. He also leads the commendable World Value Network, whose mission is to impart and disseminate Jewish values to the American people and the wider world, and to promote and defend the State of Israel.
Hey everyone, this is Ari Folder. I want to invite you all to join me on my weekly show, Bulletproof, here on Israel News Talk Radio. It's the weekly show we discover, expose, and destroy all anti-Israel propaganda that spread throughout the universe, both from outside Israel, including also inside Israel. Join me every week. And let's defend Israel together.
Bulletproof. Live every Sunday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern time.
And now, here is Walter Bingham.
And now to my conversation with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. Shmuel Boteach, or Shmuley as he is affectionately known, is an American Orthodox Jewish rabbi, author, TV host, and public speaker, and the author of 30 books, most of which have a religious theme and have received public acclaim. He also leads the commendable World Value Network, whose mission is to impart and disseminate Jewish values to the American people and the wider world and to promote and defend the State of Israel. So today I want to talk about Shmuley Boteach's latest book, The Israel Warrior, with a theme that differs from his usual subjects, as the subtitle Fighting Back for the Jewish State from Campus to Street Corner indicates. It's a wake-up call to Jews around the world who pay lip service to support and defend the Jewish state or believe that by making donations to one of the many Israeli charitable institutions, they help to prevent the evil decree, the aim to destroy Israel and once again send its Jewish population back into exile. No one decries their good intent. But today we are facing a world that is different from 50 years ago, a world in which the United Nations are indeed united, but not to prevent atrocities and wars, but united against Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East. Their bias is blatant. They are not anti-Semitic, they claim, but anti-Israel. That, of course, is an excuse. One of the titles of the British monarch is Defender of the Faith. I say, and I suppose Rabbi Boteach will agree, all Jews carry that title. So already in its first pages of the book, Rabbi Boteach delineates the new direction, the new attitude that world Jewry needs to adopt when he writes, "We must make it clear that we are tired of the foul moral equivalency of Jews dying as targets of terrorists, and terrorists and Palestinians dying, undertaking acts of terrorism. We must condemn and fight a world that has indulged anti-Semitism for thousands of years and now continues that same hatred by using the State of Israel as a scapegoat to justify more Jewish corpses. We must stand up against the Western media that cares more when Israelis add rooms to apartments in eastern Jerusalem then when over 500,000 Arabs are killed in Syria. Today I'm pleased that Rabbi Boteach has joined me on the telephone from his home in New Jersey to elaborate on some of the points he makes in his latest book. Welcome to Walter's World.
Thank you very much for having me, Walter. Happy Hanukkah, God bless you.
And to you too. This is a book that has long been waiting to be written. It is intended, in your words, as a handbook for the Israel warrior. For the uninitiated, already the first few pages give a very good bullet point history of the connection of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, about Zionism, and about our ancient capital, Jerusalem. But while on the one hand, Rabbi Boteach, you explain and describe wonderfully the normality of life in Israel, you introduce a warning note about the threat from Hamas, alerting the reader of false bravado and having to overcome fear. Isn't that at least, to some extent, contradicting your statement that I read in the introduction?
Well, let me first say that I like what you articulated about every Jew being a defender of the faith. Yes, indeed, Queen Elizabeth is called a defender of the faith in the Anglican Church, but we Jews have experienced irrational and unmitigated assault throughout the centuries, and it's forced us to be on the defensive. I'd rather not be on the defensive. I'd much rather be proactive than spreading Jewish values, spreading the light of the Jewish people. We don't want to be fighters. We become fighters only when we're forced to fight. Hanukkah is an example of a holiday which celebrates not the Jewish military victory over the Assyrian Greeks 2 millennia ago, although it also celebrates that. But it primarily celebrates the Festival of Lights, the miracle of the menorah. So we don't want to be fighters. Even when we achieve electrifying military victories, we want to bring light to the world. That is our objective. But the world kind of doesn't leave us alone. Why is, subject to academic debates and scholarship, is there an irrational anti-Semitism in the world that is at play? Many would say there is. But regardless, we are defenders of the faith. I wrote The Israel Warrior to give people the tools and the information, the facts necessary to be effective Israel warriors, to be impactful in their argument. And because the war of information is as important as the real war on the ground.
I know that times are different and these days conflicts are not necessarily decided on the battlefield. In this age of electronic communication, it's easy to make lies and libels plausible enough to be believed. There are the old blood libels and newer libels and claims by our neighbors that their connection to this land is older than that of the Jews. Even Jesus was a Palestinian. It reminds me, because of my youth, of the Nazi propaganda minister Goebbels when he said, if you tell the same lie enough times, people will believe it, and the bigger the lie, the better. But how do you suggest to silence those propagandists if it has even permeated to the highest echelons of the UN so that they apply double standards?
That's why I wrote the book. How do I suggest we do so? By being convinced of the certainty of our victory if we find the eloquence, the determination, and the conviction to make the case. You see, I wholeheartedly reject the destructive belief that the world is inherently anti-Semitic and therefore bias and prejudice against our convincing argument that we're not speaking to fertile ground, that we're speaking to hostile ground that will forever filter out the rationality and the sanity and the logic of our argument. I think that is a self-defeating argument, that people are anti-Semitic, they hate Israel, let's not even try. To answer your question directly, I believe that we can achieve victories in the marketplace of ideas. I believe that with all my heart. We have to know the facts. Israel is a just, moral, and righteous democracy. Israel is not just a Jewish state, although it is primarily that. Israel is the great hope for the Arab states. If one country in a tyranny-filled sea of oppression, of brutality, like can't succeed with Western-style democratic values, then all the Arab states can succeed with the same. So Israel is a litmus test for governments based on human rights, freedom of press, freedom of religion, all the things that we cherish in the United States, and all the things that are so central to Jewish values, the time-honored Jewish values that predate the United States. Israel is the litmus test for those values.
But what basis do the Palestinian Arabs have for their claim, and do they really want the Palestinian state?
Well, the problem with a Palestinian state, of course, is that if it were Switzerland or Sweden, I don't think you would have the kind of hostility that you have from so many who love, care about, and defend Israel. A Palestinian state, it's not Switzerland. It will be a state, unfortunately, governed by Hamas, which is a genocidal terrorist organization sworn to the spilling of as much Jewish blood as possible. All polls show that if there is a Palestinian state created, it will be quickly dominated by Hamas. Just as Gaza was quickly dominated by Hamas, and we've seen how Israel has had to fight three wars just to defend itself against Hamas's genocidal intent. There can be no discussion of a Palestinian state until there can be some kind of assurance that any such discussion will lead not just to a demilitarized state, but to a state that is a total peace and harmony based on democratic values. Then that is not a possibility in the foreseeable future by any stretch of the imagination. Another hostile state on its border dedicated to its annihilation the way it already has one, because Hezbollah in the north, Gaza in the west, and Iran in the east, it can't put up with yet another one. There are limits to Israel's security risk, and this is a risk way too far.
But this option is now seriously being considered, even by President Trump, as we heard. Is it viable in Yehuda and Shomron, the heartland of Israel?
President Trump has established strong bona fides on Israel. He recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, even though to us that's self-evident that Israel's capital has been Jerusalem for 3,000 years since it was established by King David. There's no great insight in seeing that, but incredible courage on the part of the president in recognizing that. In addition, President Trump spoke out against the UN resolution that President Obama allowed to pass condemning Israel in December of 2016. Trump has shown tremendous friendship with Israel and the Jewish people. So he should be given the benefit of the doubt when it comes to his intentions about Israel in general, because he has shown himself to be a true friend and has spoken out many times in favor of Israel. Having said that, that doesn't mean that every proposal that's going to come from the White House is going to be first and foremost in Israel's interest. notwithstanding the good intentions of President Trump and his incredible team of advisors, all of whom are lovers of Israel, David Friedman or Jared Kushner or Jason Greenblatt. These are people who've established the strongest reputations as allies and friends and supporters of Israel. But so notwithstanding their good intentions, there will be some things that Israel is going to have to examine very carefully and weigh and respond. If there is talk right now about the establishment of a Palestinian state, I, whose opinion does not matter as much as an Israeli's, obviously, that's self-evident, but I would say, and by the way, I do have children who served in the IDF, but even so, I don't live in Israel, and I'm not subject to the risks that Israelis are subject to.
I hope one day you'll make it to live here.
Well, we're very, very proud of our children's service in the IDF, but I hope that any discussion of a Palestinian state will be delayed until the Palestinian Authority demonstrates any kind of accountability in running a state. Right now, they're paying for terrorists in Israeli jails, funding them when they murder Jews. Right now, they are riddled. They're a kleptocracy, riddled with corruption. Right now, they're sharing government with Hamas. Hamas, a genocidal organization of monsters who are dedicated and sworn to Israel's annihilation. So, in my opinion, there can be no discussion of a Palestinian state until such time as we see even the rudiment of a state that would be at peace with Israel, and there is no such sign at this point.
Let me move on, because we digressed here. You wrote in the book that Israel is not perfect, and that there is enough negative coverage so that we must concentrate on the positive aspects of our society. But wouldn't it be more effective if we talk about the untrue negative allegations and then demolish them rather than just praising ourselves?
Well, first of all, nobody's perfect, perhaps with the exception of me. At least I got a little chuckle from you for that. Nobody's perfect except God. But Israel is one of the most righteous and impressive countries with its dedication to human rights and freedom that the world has seen in its history. A country surrounded by enemies that still has all of these freedoms, that runs by the rule of law, that has 1.5 million Muslim citizens with all the rights of Israeli citizens. In fact, Israel practices reverse discrimination against its Jewish Israeli citizens by coercing them, understandably, to go to the military when Arabs are absolved of military service. And if you think that's not a big thing, look at what happened in America when they forced Americans to go to the Vietnam draft. This country was almost torn apart by a compulsive military, and Jews submit to it eagerly to protect Israel, and our Arab brothers and sisters who are citizens of Israel are not subject to that draft. So Israel is one of the most impressive and electrifying democracies the world has ever seen. And still it's imperfect, and it should be imperfect, because it's run by people. But of course, in my life, in my rabbinical calling, I dedicate myself towards responding to the fraudulent allegations, the defamatory, libelous, and fraudulent allegations against the Jewish state. And I try to do so as convincingly as possible based on whatever talent the Almighty has given to me. I am a Jew. I am immensely proud of the fact that I am a Jew. I am a son of my people. I have always sought to be a servant of my people. I love being Jewish. I do not feel I am better than anyone by being a Jew. I do not feel I am less than anyone else by being a Jew. I just feel that I am a Jew. That is my core identity. I will always seek to contribute to the world as a Jew, and I will always seek to protect and defend my people.
We want to move on. So how can Israel deal with the hate that came with their mother's milk? And what about the alternative? I've yet to hear the answer to deal with the inevitable demographic problem. If we annex the territories now administered by the Palestinian Authority, the part that's erroneously called the West Bank, and I've never heard of a riverbank so large, and incorporate another 2.5 million to the already 1.6 million Arabs living in Israel, what should the status of these more than 4 million Arabs be if Israel is to remain a democracy? And I haven't even mentioned Gaza. So which option do you consider to be the greater existential threat to our Jewish democratic state, bearing in mind the consequences of our evacuation of Gaza in 2005 and the other demographics that are connected with this?
Well, any country that has experienced a genocide in living memory must always first and foremost address the military physical threat. That is the foremost threat. The foremost threat to the Jewish people is Hamas, Iran, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, all of these organizations that are threatening Israel with the second Holocaust, especially Iran. So that's the foremost threat. the demographic should be addressed. Firstly, the Jewish people are not a proselytizing faith, so we rely entirely and almost exclusively on birth rate for our numbers. So we need more Jewish children, which I believe in more babies anyway. I love babies. I have 9 children, thank God.
Baruch Hashem.
The Jewish people suffered for the loss of 6 million just 70 years ago. And we should be making up those numbers with larger families, stronger families, more robust families. I understand the demographic challenges, but they are, of course, subordinate to the physical challenges of a nation living in the most dangerous region in the world, whose enemies don't even mask or disguise their intention. They speak openly about annihilating the Jewish people.
I'm in conversation with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, discussing his book, The Israel Warrior, with the subtitle Fighting Back for the Jewish State from Campus to Street Corner. Rabbi Boteach, it isn't easy to be all things to all men, but it seems that our Prime Minister is constantly trying. On the one hand, he advocates the two-state solution on condition that the leadership of the Palestinian state recognizes the Jewish state of Israel, but equally importantly, that it will be demilitarized. On the other hand, he knows full well that a sovereign state will not remain demilitarized for more than a year or two, and will then have the Iranian guards on our doorstep. We have the best example of the Nazi government that ignored the conditions of the Versailles Treaty and in March 1936 marched into the demilitarized Rhineland. Do you think that Netanyahu really wants a two-state solution?
Well, you know, it's not for me to fathom the inner intention of the Prime Minister of Israel. I don't know people's hearts. I'm not gifted with the power of mind reading. So I will take him at his word. The better question is whether a two-state solution is the best thing for Israel. I think Prime Minister Netanyahu has been an outstanding prime minister. I think that under him, Israel has flourished economically. I think its reputation around the world, with the exception of campuses and possibly in Europe, has really flourished. Latin America, Asia, India, Africa. He's built more new relationships with Israel than any prime minister that has preceded him. And Israel has become very strong. And now, you know, he had a poor relationship with President Obama, but he has an outstanding relationship with President Trump. So I praise this prime minister. Do I believe that a two-state solution is in Israel's interest? As I said, if the second state is Switzerland, sure. It's not Switzerland, and therefore it's not in Israel's interest.
He also knows that a border that in places would run 70 meters from the main Trans-Israel Highway, Route 6, would be too much temptation for deviant militant groups within that state to ignore and take advantage of it. We only need to look at the example of Northern Ireland. Netanyahu knows full well that the current Palestinian Arab leadership does not want a second state, but the whole of the Jewish land between the river and the sea. And even if Abbas would agree, we can guess that his successor may not abide by that decision. Again, back to Nazi Germany, they did it within 10 years of indoctrination and the poison is not yet cleared out. If there were a Palestinian state on our doorstep, how could we secure peace after they had 70 years of indoctrination?
Well, that's what I'm saying. We're talking about the wrong region here. A two-state solution with Hamas as the state? Are we kidding ourselves? Israel will be sandwiched between Hamas in the west in Gaza and in the east in Judea and Samaria. That's a recipe for suicide. So obviously it's not viable and it should not be discussed at this point. We tried it in Gaza. It was a catastrophe. Absolute catastrophe. There have been 3 wars in a decade. How much more catastrophic can it be? There have been tens of thousands of rockets raining on Israel's citizens. How much more catastrophic can it be? We cannot try it in Judea and Samaria. Like I said, if the Palestinian state was Finland or Norway, I don't think Israelis would be opposed to it. But it's not. It's Hamas. They are genocidal monsters. They are killers. They are cold-blooded murderers. And they cannot be given a state by which to launch new wars against Israel, where Israel is fighting on 2 fronts against this terrorist entity.
There have been suggestions to have a UN force entrusted with keeping the peace. But we've seen their response to Nasser's request in 1956, and they withdrew, and UNIFIL in Lebanon pretends that they don't see anything. I know that you can give a lot of other examples of UN peacekeepers failing in their task.
Well, The UN does a lot of good around the world when it comes to trying to end poverty and distribute food, when it comes to helping to address disease and cure disease. But when it comes to deploying peacekeeping troops to prevent a war, they have a terrible record. Look at Rwanda, which is the worst example of all. Astonishing that the UN in 1994 withdrew its peacekeeping forces so that the Hutus could go and slaughter the Tutsis at the rate of about 300 an hour for 3 months, killing 1 million people in the fastest mass murder in the history of the world. The UN disgraced itself. And there are many other examples. I would not trust the UN to keep the peace, and the UN has shown way too much bias and outright hostility toward Israel. I trust Israel to defend its own interests, and we Jews have learned the hard way that it is for us to protect and defend ourselves and not to rely on external agencies, and that is the message of Hanukkah. And Walter, I can pleasure. You're an extremely articulate and well-informed interview, and it's been a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, I've got a few more questions. I've already discussed the anti-Israel bias of the UN in a recent program that concluded that this incongruous body should be disbanded. You know the famous quote attributed to Benjamin Netanyahu: if the Arabs put down their weapons today, there'd be no more violence, and if the Jews put down their weapons, there'd be no Israel. There are also the allegations, I'd like you to comment on, that the settlements are an obstacle to peace, when in fact there were no settlements before 1967, were there? How can we convince not only the international community, but also the misinformed general public that Israel would like nothing better than to live in peace with its neighbors and to be able to spend less on defense and more on the many fields that benefit the world as a whole?
We're the people of the book. You know, we don't want to be the people of the M16. We don't want to be the people of the Galil assault rifle. We sometimes need to utilize those weapons just to keep ourselves alive. But these wars are all defensive in nature. The IDF is called the Israel Defense Forces. It's not even called the Israeli Army. That's just a euphemism that we use. The IDF is to defend Jewish life. So we want to be famous, hopefully, as a light into the nations, a harbinger of democracy and human rights in the Middle East. We want to be, God willing, continue to be a technological superpower, exporting important life-saving technologies to the world, medical technologies, everyday technologies, making people's lives safer and healthier and easier. Waze is an example. It's an overutilized example, but a brilliant example nonetheless. It's not just an impressive technology. It makes your life better. It means people getting home to see their kids can get home faster. It means that people who want to visit their parents can get there faster. We spend less time on the road and more time being with the people that we love or the meetings that we have to do, etc. But we want to do more of that, and I believe that will continue.
The international community tells us, look, we don't want to impose anything on you. You have to sit down and discuss it with the other party. But the international community also blindly believes in the current leader of the Palestinian Authority as a moderate peace partner with whom Israel will come to a final settlement of the conflict. But this man's doctoral thesis had the title "The Connection Between the Nazis and the Leaders of the Zionist Movement." And in his book, he argues that the Holocaust has been exaggerated and that the Zionists created the myth of 6 million murdered Jews, which he called a fantastic lie, a man who was the paymaster of the Munich Olympic massacre and who to this very day glorifies the terrorists as martyrs for the cause. Should we even attempt to negotiate with him?
Well, Mahmoud Abbas, his doctoral thesis course was one of Holocaust denial, which has never been fully repudiated. He has made common sense to the effect that he understands the Holocaust was the worst crime, etc. But, you know, in his doctoral thesis, he says that only 1 million Jews died. And then he kind of blames the Zionists for the Holocaust. It's a disgusting thesis. But we don't have to go back to the 1980s or earlier to the Munich.
Unfortunately, during the interview, we twice lost the line, and eventually the sound quality became too bad to continue, and therefore the sudden end, 10 minutes early. We did, however, get a good insight into Rabbi Boter's views concerning the future of the Jewish state and its policy toward our Palestinian Arab neighbor. The recent allegations surrounding the presidency of Donald Trump about collusion with the Russians to affect his election and the machinations to avoid any meaningful and unbiased investigation
into the alleged security breaches of Hillary Clinton and her email affairs have been rumbling on for the past year. In fact, they've never been out of the headlines. I must confess that as time goes on and more information comes to light, I'm getting more and more confused. So I hope that in the next program, I shall be able to talk with a prominent US personality who can unravel for us those intricate knots. And finally, police this week arrested three youths on the Temple Mount after they recited the Shema prayer. Isn't that ridiculous? Here is my thought for the week. A negative mind will never give you a positive life. And with that, I end for today. I hope to be back again next week with another selection of news, views, and interviews from Israel and the rest of the Jewish world. Until then, this is Walter Bingham wishing you a good and safe week. Be careful when you drive because this is a busy week on the road. And of course, please visit your elderly neighbor. You see, at festival time, they get particularly melancholy and need company. Goodbye.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio. Straight talk from Israel.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.